Succession number 28424, reel number 2.
We're in hands, reel 2. So, what happened again as you arrived in Kuala Lumpur?
Well, the regimental headquarters was at our former estate, 2 or 3 miles north of KL. Sorry, I will refer to Kuala Lumpur as KL from now on, because everybody did and does. On an estate called Wardyburn, and that was the regimental HQ. And it was there that the incoming drafts received their jungle training, which was a period of 3 to 4 weeks, conducted obviously by extremely experienced officers and NCOs, and that was one's first introduction to the fact that you were going to spend the next few months in a bath of perspiration and a very hard physical activity, because Malaya is a mountainous country, and the jungle backbone, as it were, makes for hard walking.
Can you describe the type of jungle that's indicative to Malaya?
Yeah, there are. Well, to begin with, before we start on the jungle, perhaps the lower levels, topographically speaking, were rubber plantations, and these plantations were laid out in military formation, exactly the same distance between the trees as had been determined by years of experience, I imagine, and then as you climbed higher, so you got to the jungle edge where the clearing work had ceased, and the jungle became what it was and what it had been before it had been cleared for rubber. Again, the further up you went, the more open it became. The trees became more widely spaced. The vistas, again, much, much wider than lower down, where it could be very choked with secondary growth of one sort and another. But it was the heat and humidity that was what struck you first, and secondly, I suppose, the enormous cacophony which took place over your head in the canopy, both apes of every sort and birds of every sort, many of which you never even saw, let alone identify, but an absolute screaming match from dawn till dusk.
What about underfoot? What was it like to move?
Again, the further up you went, obviously the drier it became. Lower down, it was frequently swampy. The army had designed a very appropriate piece of footwear, the jungle boot, which made no pretense at keeping water out, but did allow it to get out again once it had got in, so a canvas top on a solid rubber bottom. It could be slippery and slidey, it could be quite easy walking.
You said there could be quite a tangle of secondary growth.
Yeah.
Would that be difficult to move through?
Yes, and worse than that, of course, it produced visibility problems, which were always uppermost in the mind of any patrol leader. You know, what you could see and who could see you. Again, primary jungle, as it was called, up at the top, was clear of those problems.
Would the jungle, as we understand jungle, would it be almost impenetrable, or would it be crisscrossed with tracks and
yes.
animal?
Yes, yes, walk? Particularly on ridgetops. Yes, animal tracks, wild pig in the main. I did actually, in the course of my 12 months, see two tigers. But of course, they were keen to get out of the way as quickly as possible. But it was a marvellous sight, I must say.
Was it dangerous to encounter, say, a wild pig?
Yeah, especially with young. Yes, a wild pig is a sort of four-legged tank, and they don't take kindly to the human race.
And when you saw the tigers, were they just moving through the...
Yes, as I say, wild animals by and large don't hang about when encountering human beings, so it was very brief. They were off, gone.
What about insects?
Oh, what about insects? Well, there are a few things in one's memory worse than sitting under a tree in, say, a night ambush situation with a colony of ants walking across you, up and down you, side to side, and being able to do nothing about it. No, insects were dreadful.
What about mosquitoes? Were they prevalent?
Yes, indeed. One was being bitten morning, noon and night. It was, of course, a serious military offence to catch malaria. And to this end, a small tablet called Paludrin was swallowed every morning by everybody. As I say, not to do so and to catch malaria was an offence.
As an officer, would you have to enforce that?
It became part of daily drill. Everybody, you know, that's what you did. Everybody did it, and everybody understood why. I can't think anybody would have been in any way tempted not to do so.
Were leeches a problem?
Yes, also. You will know, I'm sure, about some leech inspections when everybody stood round the semicircle without benefit of trousers, and cigarettes were passed round to burn them off. Most unpleasant animals.
Would you be aware that on occasion that they'd actually attached
the trousers? No, that was the whole point of the inspection. You didn't know, and your fellow patrollers didn't know, and that's why you had to look at each other to make sure that you were clear.
Were there any other sort of insect or animal problems within the jungle?
No, I think the leeches and the insects generally were what one had to contend with. I don't recall anything else.
What about flora? Obviously, in moving through the jungle, were there the plants that you try to avoid for any reason at all? Would there be?
Poisonous plants? I certainly had no knowledge or training in poisonous plants. Whether there were any, I don't know. Yes, the thorny things were certainly to be avoided. Obviously for deep scratches, which under those weather conditions could turn septic very quickly. So, yeah, you tried to avoid that.
In this 3-week training period, obviously you mentioned before the training that you'd received was of little use out there.
I would say a little use, but it just wasn't relevant.
What were the things that you were gaining knowledge of during that 3-week training?
Oh, the whole basis of experience, the sort of ongoing law of jungle work, which the regiment and, of course, other regiments had devised for itself by experience over the years that they had been doing the job. So, yes, patrolling work, firearms training, of course, because that was a rather different area to that we had been used to in the UK. Different weapons, different techniques.
Could you enlarge on that a little bit?
Oh, sure. As I said, the standard infantry weapon in 1950 was still the Lee Enfield rifle. We also had Lee Enfields, but a much shortened and lighter version called the Mark V, which had far less woodwork and therefore was much more convenient in the jungle. But the firepower was hugely greater than the European equivalent. That is to say, 9mm automatic weapons, in our case, a modification, an improvement, a modernization of the former Sten gun called the Owen, which I believe was Australian in origin. Platoon commanders and sergeants carried Winchester carbines, and of course the trusty Bren gun was the heavy weapon, as it were. Much more firepower than you would get in an infantry platoon in Europe at that time. So all those weapons had to be learnt, and the use of them, and cleaning and care and maintenance and so on. And so there was quite a lot of range work, training people in using them. And in the whole process of getting from A to B in the jungle, which of course for an officer or sergeant was a huge exercise in map reading and compass work, which the soldiers didn't undergo that sort of training. It was a very, very crammed 3 weeks, as you can imagine, ending with an actual out-of-camp jungle exercise for real, 3 or 4 days probably. And at the end of that, you were then assigned to your company, and the company arrangements at that time were, I remember rightly, two based about 12 miles south of Kale in a small town called Kajang, one on the state north of Kale called Bukit Dara, and probably one actually at Waterburn itself, in the Kale area.
At that time, what was the kind of insurgent activity in the kind of Kale area like?
In town, we did not carry arms, and I don't recall any terrorist activity in my time there at all. Of course, out of town and in the country as a whole, incidents were daily.
Was it particularly a hotbed of activity in comparison with other areas of the country at that time?
Well, certainly Kajang was, yes, because it was the home of, or the base of a leading terrorist called Lu Kong Kim. And he ran what was known as the Kajang Gang, and had a particularly unpleasant local reputation.
Could you enlarge a little bit on that, how he got that reputation, the type of activity?
Oh, yeah. Intimidation at all levels, because they and CTs, I should explain, communist terrorists, they were known as CTs, or bandits. They lived in jungle camps. They had to be fed. They had to have medical supplies and treatment, even clothes. And if those supplies were not forthcoming, they couldn't continue to live and work. And work, in their sense, meant terrorist activity. So the local population was very severely lent on by intimidation of all sorts, so that these supplies could be kept rolling. To digress a bit, the situation had changed quite dramatically prior to my arrival by the implementation of a plan to resettle large numbers of mainly Chinese squatters who lived and worked outside the rural communities in small areas of their own making, where mostly they were subsistence farmers. And of course they were absolutely the people who could be relied upon to provide the necessary food and other equipment by intimidation. Not, I think, mostly, but any of them particularly supported the objectives of the people in the jungle. That resettlement program brought them into protected areas with wire and other forms of perimeter protection, and police guard posts, and everybody had identity cards, and it became more difficult for the people in the jungle to get that supply train moving. And our job, of course, was to hinder that process by any means, particularly ambushing, when we had information that people were on the move from A to B for the purpose of supply.
When you'd done that kind of 3 weeks training, how much information did you have about the local CTs? How much would you be given?
In that period, none, because it was only relevant on the ground when you were on the ground. Once one became, as it were, on active service, and just to go back to what I said quite a bit earlier, we were, strictly speaking, not allowed to leave camp unless requested to do so by the police. We were serving in aid of the civil power. But in practice, on the ground, it meant that at local level, the local police and intelligence services worked very closely with our own intelligence people. They worked in the same office, they shared the knowledge, and decided on an appropriate plan of action for that day or that week, depending on what information might have come in from one source or another.
In your opinion, was it a good relationship?
Yes, excellent. Yeah. At my level, I had very little personal contact, but more senior colleagues, as I say, had daily contact. And when you were on company detachment, this meant that your company commander or your second in command was in daily contact with the local police, and information was exchanged, and as I say, a course of action decided upon. There were probably three forms of activity in which we engaged on a regular basis. One, well, first of all, you had to have a rapid response unit on a daily basis, the standby section. And when the hooter went, that group, which was literally armed and ready to go, got in the transport, was either briefed on the spot as to what had happened, probably, let's say, an attack on a rubber plantation. Inevitably, with the terrain and the distance involved, I don't recall any occasion when that rapid response unit ever actually found anybody there by the time they got there, but at least they could be seen to be, by the locals, to be in action. And secondly, the ambushing program, which again, of course, depended entirely on information that something, that there was to be movement from A to B on a particular night, not always at night time. And then there was the regular patrolling, which may or may not have been based on information, but a general view that one should get around the district as much as possible. And very frequently things were discovered which were unknown, and that's where a lot of the jungle actions took place.
If I can take that last one, the patrolling, what kind of rotor system would you use for different elements of the company to patrol?
Well, there was an ongoing manpower problem. I think the standard number of an infantry platoon at that time was probably 40 men. Well, I never had anything like 40 men. I doubt if it was 30. And so we usually operated as two sections to give a wider spread. And anyway, there's a very sound tactical reason for this, because if you are operating in single file, the chances of number 6 down to number 12 actually being usefully engaged in the sort of quick jungle action that took place were very remote. So numbers were not significant, bearing in mind that we were so extraordinarily strongly armed. So yes, section patrols, very seldom the full platoon, and only then perhaps if you were out for 3 or 4 nights, and then often you would be based in a jungle camp of your own making and do day patrols from there. The idea was to cover as much ground as possible and see what sort of activity might be going on.
With a section patrol,
mm-hmm.
How would you organise it?
Well, you had a leading group, which consisted of the patrol commander, a leading scout who might have to do some hatchet work if the going was heavy. We all had long-bladed... They were called parangs, which was the Malay word for them. Usually a Bren gunner, so you had a lot of firepower up at the front. It depended on the terrain whether the patrol commander led or whether he took second place. And second place was important if you had some tricky map reading to do. You had to be quite sure that you were taking your patrol in the direction it was supposed to be going in. And if you were in front, obviously your full attention was on what was going on around you rather than the map and the compass. But if I always led myself unless that situation meant that I got to do a lot of map work. I think most of my colleagues reacted in the same way. Needless to say, we wore no badges of any sort, so nobody could say the guy in the front was the leader or the commander or who he was or where he was.
How was the firepower distributed amongst the patrol?
Probably only 2 or 3 riflemen amongst that group of 12-15 men. The toughest job, without doubt, was that of the signaller, who carried the most enormous radio set. So he had a rifle, which was the lightest form of weaponry, and maybe 2 or 3 others, but the rest would all be automatics.
And should you be patrolling through the jungle and some form of contact was made, how would the section then deploy?
Well, again, it depended on the terrain and the nature of the activity. There were occasions when literally, certainly in open country like a rubber estate, when contact was made visually, it never happened to me. The most usual thing was to come upon a camp. And you hoped that you would come upon it in such a way that you could devise a satisfactory method of attack. Often you came upon camps which were uninhabited for one reason or another. These were always burnt, so at least they couldn't be used again until they'd been rebuilt. It's very difficult. There's no hard and fast rule about what to do, the circumstances decided what to do, and it all happened so very quickly that you just did, as I say, what the situation required.
You mentioned the signaller there. What were communications?
Dreadful. Dreadful. This was a different world 50 years ago. A different world. In the event of, well, for example, if you were out at night, you would need to report back to your commanding officer. It might be your company commander. It might be the intelligence people. You would therefore be required to make a daily signal back to base to report where you were, what you'd been doing, what you'd seen, or indeed if you hadn't seen anything. The letters NTR were most common. NTR standing for Nanterre Roger, nothing to report. To get that contact, the set, which of course is battery powered, so they had to be carried as well. Enormous aerial arrangements had to be made as high up as the signaller could get them. A lot of twiddling of knobs, and you might not make contact, but it was not something that could be done instantly. If you had been the subject of a serious ambush and lost men, it would take hours to do anything about it. That was the only contact. Things are so different nowadays. You read and see on the television of everybody having a microphone and talking to each other without any problems at all. And we just certainly did not enjoy that.
What were you wearing? You mentioned jungle boots, but what was the equipment that you would wear?
Oh, very, 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 very simple. A hat. A jungle hat. I still have mine. A bush jacket type garment and trousers. No underclothes, because they just got soaked and chafed. Thick grey socks and a jungle boot. Life of a jungle boot was about 3 weeks, because the protection underfoot wore out, and the protection underfoot was very important for thorns that you mentioned earlier, and that was it. And then on top of that you had a belt, and round the belt was your water bottle, in my case compass, spare magazines for the carbine, and usually two grenades, one HE, otherwise known as a Mills bomb, so I don't think it changed since 1918, and a phosphorus grenade, which was a very handy thing to have, and I used subsequently to good effect. If that was a day patrol equipment, if of course you were going out for longer, then you carried your house on your back. And again, it's just so different then compared to today. Tins. We carried tins of food. The usual ration things, stewing steak and biscuits and bacon and egg and, oh my goodness me, and mess tins, of course, and Tommy cookers and everything necessary to heat this stuff up at night. I was very fortunate in that my section corporal was adventurous in the culinary situation, so we always had rice and curry and so forth, which did cheer things up immensely. And tea, of course, gallons of tea. But no, we had a 3-day patrol was seriously hard work with that lot on your back and your poncho cape, which was your bed. A lot of weight and a lot of hills to climb.